Blog Talk Radio. A seductive short story collection, a novel visit to paradise, and a paperback that Oprah is cheering about. These are the books we're featuring on tonight's episode of the Literary New England Radio Show. It's Monday, March 16th, 2015. I'm Cindy Wolf Boynton. Please stay with us for author talk and book giveaways as I talk with Rose Tremaine about her short story collection, The American Lover, Tatiana Soli on her novel, The Last Good Paradise, and former Massachusetts resident Rachel Urquhart, whose novel, The Visionist, comes out in paperback tomorrow, March 17th. Oprah singled out The Visionist as one of nine hit books finally out in paperback form that now can be tossed in a bag and taken to a park or the shore. And because they are just so, so good, these are books that were absolutely worth the wait. We had Rachel on the show back in early 2014 to talk about the hardcover release of The Visionist. And I'm so excited about the softcover version coming out tomorrow that I thought I'd share an edited version of that previous talk with you tonight. Rachel's so well spoken, and her book is also just so extraordinary.
Well, the novel takes place in 1842 in a fictional Shaker community and also in the poor rural farming towns around that community. And it's narrated by three characters. One of them is an abused farm girl named Polly Kimball who suffers from a kind of post-traumatic stress response of, you know, going into hallucinatory states. And she ends up in a Shaker community called the City of Hope, which is in the throes of a religious revival, a revival that actually happened, as it happens, within the Shaker community. And they see her in a state of hallucinating, and they decide that she's a visionist, which is what they called the young teenage girls who fell into similar types of states. And so she's exalted to, you know, being a visionist. And visionists were these teenage girls who had the Shakers felt had a kind of connection with the divine, particularly the spirit of the founder of Shakerism, whose name was Mother Ann Lee. So Polly becomes a very important figure within this community. And the second character is a young Shaker of her age named Sister Charity, who becomes very, very close friends with Polly. And so it's a little bit about the way they grow up in this community and affect one another. And then the third character is a character named Simon Pryor, who is an arson investigator, and he investigates the fire that occurs early in the book and then gets sort of drawn into, you know, the lives of the characters who are all affected by that fire.
So I know that you grew up in Massachusetts. Did this story come from that experience or something you experienced as a younger person?
It's interesting. You know, I grew up in, my grandfather bought a converted Shaker meeting house in the 30s, and I grew up spending every summer in that house and almost every weekend as well throughout the year. And so you'd think that that it's really obvious that it was written about the Shakers, but in fact, having the whole sort of Shaker atmosphere around me all the time really made me quite complacent about the Shakers. I didn't know anything about them to speak up before I started this book. And so in the end, the fact that I grew up in a town that once held a Shaker settlement sort of had nothing to do with my writing this book, at least on the surface, but probably subconsciously I was finally returning to material that, you know, maybe I was interested in all along and just didn't really know it. What really interested me in the Shakers was when I picked up a book that described these teenage girls and this religious revival period. It just seemed so strange and so at odds with my picture of the Shakers, which was more or less, I think, the picture most of us have of the Shakers, which is these very virtuous people who couldn't do any wrong and really were sort of, I never saw the Shakers as the human beings that they were. I just thought of them as these kind of, you know, virtuous constructs. And in fact, they were real people, and they came from all kinds of backgrounds, and those backgrounds affected how they behaved, and their communities were just endlessly fascinating. That's what I found out as I researched this book.
And now, do Shaker communities still exist?
There is one Shaker community in Sabbath Day Lake, Maine. Its numbers fluctuate and are not huge, and I think that, you know, I'm not sure how many are there right now, you know, one or two or ten people. It's not a whole lot of people. And they follow Shaker beliefs very, very closely. They're also, because Shakers were actually extraordinarily progressive, they're living in the 21st century very definitely, but they just sort of live their lives following Shaker morals and beliefs, and they're very helpful in their community, and they sort of are trying to keep the Shaker ideals alive in this modern world.
So, Rachel, what kind of research did you do to write this book?
Well, initially, you know, I really had to educate myself about the Shakers in general. So a lot of my early research was it was sort of superficial in a sense. I had to get some sense of who these people were as a religious movement and what the arc of that movement was. And then I got more specific and started to study this, you know, incredible time called the Era of Manifestations, which is the name of this particular religious revival. And then I started to think about, you know, specifics of Shaker life during that period. And then I started to, you know, try to crawl into the shoes of my characters and walk through these spaces at some of these incredible Shaker sites like Hangok Shaker Village and Canterbury up in New Hampshire and Enfield, New Hampshire, all these places you can go, and you can really start to get a sense of, you know, physically putting yourself in a Shaker community is a really fascinating experience. So that was sort of the most fun part of the research, but that's really how I did it. And I wrote sort of the whole time that I was researching, just because I kept stumbling across fact after fact after fact that was so fascinating or so strange, you know, that I couldn't not put it into the book. So that's how it
was. Yeah, I can imagine. And now your protagonist, Polly, is she anything like you?
Huh, I've never ever answered a question like that. I think that I shouldn't speak for other writers, but I think in order for a book to ring true with readers, there has to be a little bit of the writer in every character that they write. And so I think there are aspects of Polly's character that are that probably come from someplace deep within me. But there are probably aspects of Simon Pryor, the investigator, and aspects of Sister Charity, the Shaker girl, that come from me too. The way I thought about that was that, you know, if there was me in this novel, it was somehow coming out in a code that I was writing by writing the novel, but that I couldn't decipher. And it was probably better that I couldn't decipher it, because I think if you become too aware of, you know, working out your own issues through your books, it gets in the way of telling a good story. So on the surface, I'd say that, you know, my characters are nothing like me, but I think the truth is probably, you know, that they all have a little bit of me in them.
Sure, sure. And now, The Visionist is your first novel?
It is, yes.
So how did that come to be? Tell us a little bit about yourself and your writing history.
Sure.
I know you've worked as a journalist, correct?
Yeah, I was a magazine writer for several decades before I got up the guts and sat down and tried to write a novel. I worked at Spy magazine, and then at Vogue and at Allure, and I did a lot of freelance work with the pieces in the New Yorker and, you know, various newspapers. And so I was very lucky to be able to support myself as a magazine and sometime newspaper writer. But really, I sort of saw that time as a chance to work on learning how to write. And so it didn't bother me all that much that I wrote pieces that were pretty high on style and pretty low on substance. You know, they weren't important Pulitzer Prize winning pieces. They were sort of lifestyle pieces. And that gave me a chance to really kind of learn how to revise, learn how to respond to editors' comments, learn how to kind of not feel too attached to my writing, you know, and those skills were really helpful when I sat down to try to write a novel, because I had a whole other series of skills that I had to learn to, you know, to do that. So it helped that I had, you know, at least a working knowledge of putting sentences together under my belt, and then I could learn the rest of it.
And so has it, like, set off this second career for you as a fiction writer?
Well, I hope so, because I really I feel happiest when I'm writing fiction. I feel happiest making up stories in my head and then trying to figure out ways to put them down so that they really come through to readers. And it's been astounding to me that this story has, you know, sort of touched people and reached them. It's miraculous to me and a source of great pride and pleasure because. I've just never had that experience of having something sort of come out of my own head and have people actually understand exactly what I wanted them to understand. It's a great feeling. So that's been great, this book. So I hope that it'll happen with the next one.
And, yeah, you've gotten amazing reviews for The Visionist.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I've been very, very fortunate in that regard. It's been incredible and very surprising to me, but I'll take it.
So do you think there's a certain type of person or reader who will enjoy The Visionist more than others?
You know, it's interesting. I might have thought there was, when it first came out, I might have thought that it was really primarily for people who like period fiction. But I've had so many people come up to me and say, I don't normally like period fiction, but I found so many situations that are completely modern in your book that I actually didn't read it as period fiction at all. And so I've been surprised. I also have found a lot of men have come up to me and said, you know, I don't usually like fiction. I read nonfiction, and I loved your book, and I felt that I learned so much, but at the same time, I was totally drawn into the story. So I feel as though the kind of the world that I thought would receive this book well has expanded, you know, far beyond my wildest dreams, and I think that it seems to be appealing to a lot of people. I think the one group that it might not appeal to is, you know, the video game crowd who needs, you know, an explosion every other sentence. That's not this book. You know, it's just not like that. But I think it has other things that people find worthwhile.
And you have a wonderful website. Can you tell us that address and what people will find there?
Absolutely. The address is my name, Rachel Urquhart, and then with the word writer attached, and that's all one word, so rachelurquhartwriter.com. And I try to really put a lot of background information about the Shakers into various blogs that I've written on the website, and just so people could get a sense of who these amazing people were, and maybe a slightly different sense than they've ever had before, because I think that it's a pretty different portrayal of the Shakers than Elisa and I had read previously, and they were incredible, and they were human, and they were fascinating in their humanness, as well as because they made beautiful furniture, and because they, you know, did all the things that they did. They were also just really interesting people. And so I hope that my website sort of expands on that theme and gives people some information and some photographs and things that sort of allow them to picture that world.
Rachel, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Cindy. It's been a pleasure.
I have a copy of The Visionist that I'd love to give to you. Win it by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. If you follow Literary New England on Twitter, and we're poking around there today, you might know that we also have a couple of copies of Eric Larson's Dead Wake, which is about the sinking of the Lusitania, to give away to you. Eric was in New England this past week. He was at Mount Holyoke College for a talk and signing, at the Harvard Bookstore, at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord, New Hampshire, and at Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont. If you're like me and most bummed because you didn't get to see him in person, maybe I can make you feel better by helping you win a copy of Dead Wake. To be in the running, find Lit New England on Twitter and retweet the tweet that we sent out around 5:46 p.m. today, which says, book giveaway. Retweet before midnight and you could win a copy of Dead Wake by Eric Larson. From all those who hit the retweet button by midnight, we'll randomly pick two to receive Dead Wake, and we'll tweet the names of the winners tomorrow. Good luck. Remember that all past episodes of the Literary New England Radio Show can be found in our Blog Talk Radio archives. You can also download us as an iTunes podcast, though generally, if you want to win a book written by one of the authors we're featuring, your best bet is to listen live. Right now, I have a copy of Rose Tremaine's new short story collection, The American Lover, to give away to you, which you can win by either tweeting or emailing us. Rose is British. She lives in Norfolk and London, England, and that's where New England's roots are from those who in the 17th century traveled by ship from England across the Atlantic and established this New England right here. A little trivia for you, a 1616 booklet is believed to be the first time this region was described in print, with authors applying the term New England to coastal lands that stretch from what's now roughly Long Island Sound, Connecticut, up to as far as Newfoundland. The short stories that are in Rose Tremaine's The American Lover are not set in New England, but like the region itself, they are rich, they are enticing, and they are unforgettable.
This has been put together over quite a few years. I think it's about 9 years. So there's no sense in which it was written as a collection. I think stories occupy the same space in my writing life as poems probably do in the life of a poet. That is to say, you know, they come when they come, and that's not by no means all the time. And I fit them in with other work. And then several years go by, and then I realize I've got enough to put together as a collection. But I think what readers will find from this is not so much interlinked themes, which is one way of putting a story collection together, but a huge amount of diversity, both in subject matter and length and in voice and everything.
So what do we see? What are some of the stories in The American Lover?
Well, the title story is, there's a couple of connections here as stories that are in some way, shape or form about writing. And the American Lover story is about a very young girl who falls in love inappropriately at the age of 19 and has her heart broken, and thinks that she can in some way capitalize on this heartbreak by writing about it. And she writes what turns out to be a very successful novel based on this slightly transgressive love affair. And it does very well, rather like I was thinking when I wrote this about the first book of François Sagan called Bonjour Tristesse, which she was about 19, about the same age, and it sold, you know, worldwide and made her a lot of money. And this is what happens to this girl here. She makes a lot of money, but she spends it. She wastes it and winds up in a car crash with her legs broken. So the thing which she thinks is going to assuage the heartbreak, i.e. the writing about it, which, of course, writing can sometimes do. It can sometimes make grief or the things that you're suffering much more bearable. But in this case, it really has, she's hurt once and then she's hurt all over again by the writing. So there's a connection between this story and one or two of the others. There's a story called The Housekeeper, which has the writer Daphne du Maurier as a central character. But actually, what I've done there is to make real one of Daphne's invented characters, the famous Mrs. Danvers in Rebecca, has become...
Oh, my goodness, so creepy she is.
She's creepy. I know, and that's all people remember her as. And what I wanted to do here was to resurrect her in a kind of way and to envisage a kind of a real Mrs. Danvers who has her roots in a very unhappy Polish past where she's a Jewish character who's been... her family have brought her away from Poland in the 1930s for obvious reasons, and she finds herself working in this house in England. But she has this very haunted past. And then she's hurt all over again by Daphne du Maurier by being cast in this role of kind of villain in the Rebecca story. So that's the second writer connection, and the third is a story called The Jester of Astapovo, which is a story about the last days of Tolstoy's life, in which I think some of your listeners may know what happened at the end of Tolstoy's life, which is he ran away from his wife he couldn't bear, and was traveling sort of through these great long distances in Russia towards a refuge in his sister's home, and he was taken ill at this little station called Astapovo, and he was taken in by the station master, and he actually died in the station master's house in this little way station in the middle of nowhere. And this, that story, I was really intrigued actually by that as the end of a great writer's life, and what had the way I've told that story is to tell it from the station master's point of view. So this is one of my favorite things in fiction, is taking a real character but having him, as it were, not center stage. He's not the voice of the story. The voice of the story is the station master's story. But there are reflections on writing and the way it's quite perilous to have writers in the family.
So, Rose, you said at the beginning of our conversation that it took you roughly, or these are stories that you wrote over roughly 9 years. Mm. So during that time, you also published several novels. I mean, you have what? This is your 16th book, roughly?
Something like that. I think it is about my 16th book, yeah. But I've been writing a long time. You know, I don't write terribly fast. I mean, I suppose I publish a novel once every 2 or 3 years, something like that in between. And a story, this is my fourth collection of stories. So, you know, they come up as I said, as they come, like poems come to poets.
Did you always know that you were going to be a writer?
Well, I think in some sort of slightly self-aggrandizing way, I did know this. I think I knew it. I couldn't have probably articulated it to you, but I think I had an understanding that writing, the act of writing, made me happy and was a great sort of source of consolation to me very young as a child. I mean, my parents divorced when I was 10, and my life up until that time had sort of been very, very tranquil in my life in London. You know, I went to a school that I was happy at, and so I had good friends. And then it suddenly all kind of blew apart. My mother moved house, and my sister and I were taken away from our school that we loved. And it was a very difficult year that followed. And that's when I began writing. And I think I subconsciously realized that if I could write, not necessarily the things I was feeling, but that if I could put my head somewhere else other than in my day-to-day existence, I would be a happier child. So I started writing little stories then. My sister, it was quite fun because my sister was a good artist, and so I would write the stories and she would illustrate them. So we had a little industry of two going here when I was a child.
Neat.
But of course then a long years pass and you have to go from being a child writer, to being a grown-up writer, and the road was quite long. But I always thought, actually, this is what I'm happiest doing. I couldn't have told you why, but I think that still pertains, actually. I know some writers, some friends of mine, who say that writing is an agony, but it isn't really an agony for me. It's what I am happiest working at.
So you have written both historical and contemporary stories. Is it accurate to say that, in a way, you are writing about these imagined lives that you wished or would like to have lived?
Well, a lot of them are male, as you may have noticed. So a lot of my of my protagonists are men, and I think that those are just a very sort of what I call the naked reason for that, which is that I'm most intrigued by the work when it's, you know, quite far away from me. I've deliberately chosen subjects right from the get-go. When I was, 28, 29, published my first novel, it was about an elderly man. So I've always chosen subjects which are quite distant from me. It's never been of much interest to me to kind of disinter my own biography for fiction, which is, I think, why I've been able to keep going, actually, that I haven't run out of material, because my material has always come from elsewhere. It's come from deep in the imagination, and I feel most alive when I'm trying to imagine my way into the lives of people which, you know, are very different from mine. But I mean, that's not really answered your question. Did I wish that I was some of these people? I think on the whole not. I think on the whole not. I mean, I think perhaps I like in my female characters, I probably give them more courage and more, more sort of a greater ability to cope with life than I've had. But I'm projecting a kind of idealized version of myself into, say, the protagonist of my New Zealand novel, who's a very adventurous young woman. But I don't think I wish I was them. No, not really. I'm fairly happy being me.
Any period of time that you wish that you could go back to and visit for a while?
Well, I have been very interested in the 17th century, is where my sort of what you might call my breakthrough novel, Restoration, was set, and then the follow-up that I wrote a couple of years ago called Merivale. It's a period of time which is it's very vibrant. The clothes are crazy. The whole world of England at that time, which is recovering from a rather bleak era, is very interesting to me. But I don't think, and particularly as a woman, you know, if you're asking me, you know, in an honest way, to be a woman in the 17th century would be at all an agreeable thing. So I think that imaginatively, that's a period of time which I know very well. I love writing about it. It makes me laugh. I don't know if you're familiar with the Samuel Pepys diaries, but they were a great source of inspiration to me. And one of the things I adore about them is that they're so funny, that here's a man who doesn't take himself, he's very clever, but he doesn't take himself very seriously. And he's all, you know, the reader can laugh along with him, which is I think that's my kind of preferred mode of writing, actually, is that you take fairly dark subjects and but that you arrive at some way of seeing them through a humorous light.
And Rose, I'm guessing that it's very satisfying to you that your books are not only read and loved in the UK and Europe, but all over the world.
Well, yes, I think indeed. I mean, what more could one ask? I signed a contract yesterday for an edition with Albania.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, my goodness. Exactly. And they're published in China and Taiwan and, you know. But it's terrific to have an American readership. I mean, every writer in the world longs for an American readership, you know, for obvious reasons.
And any plans to come over to the U.S. to promote The American Lover?
Well, I talked with Jill Bielofsky at Norton a lot about this, whether it was actually going to be worth it. And we couldn't really decide. And because of it's been winter and so on, I haven't done it. They haven't insisted that I do it, and I haven't done it. I've been very busy because I'm actually working both on a screenplay of one of my books and on a new novel. So I wasn't actually champing to make the trip. But maybe I'll come over, like in the autumn or something, for the paperback, and we can do some interviews or something.
Oh, that would be fabulous! So I'm guessing that your website rosetremaine.co.uk
yeah.
is the best place for people to find out more about
yeah.
you and
yeah.
check out
That's,
you if they want
brand,
to tell
it's
you
a brand new website that so.
It's a gorgeous website.
It's quite nice, quite nice. That the you know, the background to it, the birds and things. This is the wallpaper that I have in my study at home. This,
oh, come on now. The background of your website is actually your
my wallpaper. Yeah.
I love that.
Well, my study used to be decorated in, like an office, in kind of gray and brown, you know. And I thought, actually, I spend hours in here. I'm talking to you from here now. And I really wanted it to be quite a pretty room. So I went and chose this outrageous wallpaper. And when the website designer came, the first thing she asked me was, when we were putting the site together, she said, what are your favorite colors? And I said, well, look, come in here. I love the colors that are in this wallpaper. And she went mad for it. She said, oh, let's have that as the background to the website. So there it is.
Well, it's like we're in your room with you then.
Yes.
I love
yeah,
that.
That's right. Yes, it's my room.
Oh, how neat. So, Rose, tell me, what's your pitch for The American Lover? If, you know, someone perhaps is thinking of picking it up, you know, why should they go ahead and go all the way through with it?
Oh, right. Okay. I mean, writers are never very good at pitching their own work. I mean, I think what I said before is probably relevant here, which is that, I mean, I just preface that by saying I think the short story is a difficult form. It's quite what I've called it petulant in other interviews. It's quite a difficult form. And I think what I hope the readers will get from this is a real sense of craft. I have been writing for a long time now, and I believe I really understand how to work this form now. So they're getting diversity. They are getting a lot of stories about love, a lot of stories about loss of one kind or another, loss of life, loss of status, ultimately, you know, loss of people you love and so on. So there are little connections threading through if they want to see them. But what I think they're getting is big, a sense of a big world, but encapsulated in each story in a very economical way. The way I advise people to read these stories is not all one great gulp. I think it's never very satisfactory to read a short story collection like that, like you would read a novel. But I've said to people, read them like you were eating a box of chocolates. Just have one or two, and then a pause, and then try another one. You know, have them as a kind of delectation. That's what I hope.
You must have a lot of restraint if that's how you eat a box of chocolate.
Yeah, I do. Or sometimes I eat nine, you know. So.
Wonderful. Rose, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Okay, thank you.
If you haven't already tweeted or emailed us to win a copy of The American Lover, do that now. Do the same for a copy of Tatiana Soli's The Last Good Paradise, who I spoke with last week. As we're talking here, I am staring at your website, and the first thing that caught my eye was the note from Mark Twain, the quote from him, 20 years from now, you will be more disappointed by the things you didn't do than by the things you did.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of a rule that you live by?
You know, I wish I did. I try to, but it's definitely something that I had in mind when I wrote this book. It's kind of, I mean, every book that you write about is where you know, mentally where you are at that time. And I definitely, that was something that was on my mind, and it's something that I put in all my characters' minds, in, you know, in different ways.
So are you in paradise?
No. I don't think Southern California qualifies.
But you're on the East Coast. Yes, you do think that qualifies.
Yeah, maybe with the snowstorms. Yeah, it is.
Well, please, I'm so happy to talk with you today. Tell us about this new novel of yours, The Last Good Paradise.
The Last Good Paradise is kind of a novel about second chances, and it's about uprooting your life and going for something that you want. And so the book opens up with a couple, Anne and Richard, who live in Los Angeles, and they're not happy with their lives. And it's kind of a running away from home for adults book. So they go to a South Sea island, which has always been a fantasy of mine, and they kind of, you know, work on the next stage of life there.
Gosh, I hope you got to go to a South Sea island as a field trip in order to write the book.
I have been to a few resorts in my day. I have never been to a resort like I wrote about. Thank God, I think. But I think it, in a way, it's a place that we all want to go, and it's also a mental place where you're getting away from all of your problems and you can forget about the outside world existing. So I guess you really don't have to physically go to a place like that, so it's not bad if you can do that also.
So I don't know if you're going to like this description or not, but I think The Last Good Paradise is kind of an ensemble book because you meet so many different characters.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about some of those that we meet?
So I've told you about Anne and Richard. So they come from Los Angeles. Richard is a chef. He's opening, an important restaurant in Los Angeles, and that kind of implodes on him. And Anne is an attorney, and she does not like practicing the law the way she is practicing it in L.A. So they go to the South Sea Island, and they go to this an eco resort that's run by a Frenchman, Laurent. And he won the island in a poker game. And Laurent is a very mysterious character. He's kind of, you know, he's very French and he's very aloof. And he also has a bit of a drinking problem. And Anne and he end up, you know, because it's such a small place and there is nobody else, they kind of end up having a sparring kind of friendship develop and they become closer. The resort is one of these eco resorts that doesn't have electricity. It's very like, you know, I joke it's like Gilligan's Island. It's just got those thatch huts, except it's very luxe. You're having, you know, really good food and nice alcohol, and they take care of you. And so the two people that take care of the island for Laurent is Cooked and Titi, and they are Polynesians who have been on the islands for a long time. And they kind of get us into the politics, the real underbelly kind of the South Seas. And the other main characters that are already guests of the island is Dex, who's a rock and roll, kind of an aging rock and roll star. He's kind of having his own crisis with his career. And he has a young girlfriend named Wendy, who kind of transforms in the course of the book. So that's the main cast. It's a big cast for me, the type of books I write. This is a huge cast.
Yeah. What made you write this kind of story that really does have a whole ensemble of characters?
You know, I think you just, it takes a long time to write each book. And so you're very much in the rules of each book as you start to write it. And so I've written very, very focused on, you know, two, three characters before. And I really just felt like I wanted to do something playful and I did want to have that ensemble piece. So a lot of the plot unfolds through the actions of the characters interacting. It's not like they go through, you know, huge periods of time that we learn about them, their past and stuff. And so that was very much for me fun and the energy. And so I look at it as juggling. You put one ball in the air, then you throw another ball and then another ball, and it's how they're interacting in the air and spinning around each other that creates part of the fun. And so that's the mood to try to create a lighter mood. That's how I stayed that way. I think if I had narrowed it down to just one of the people, that it would have changed the tone of it. But this way I kind of get to have fun and they kind of bounce off of each other. I think of it as a really interesting cocktail party.
So was it fun for you to write?
You know, I really did. I enjoyed this. I just talk about a lot of things. I always think, you know, there's some books that you read, you know, for a historical or something that is, you know, very far from your life. And this, even though I don't know characters that are, to this degree radical, you know, in their fields and their problems. It's very much kind of the things that, you know, people around me and friends of mine talk about. It's like, you know, what are you going to do in the next stage of your life? And are you going to stay in this career, in this house, in this place where you live? Or are you going to do something crazy and go open a bed and breakfast in some, you know, South Sea Island or a mountain resort or stuff? So I think it's kind of, it's kind of the things that go on in your mind that you might not act on. And these characters, because they're a little bit more, you know, they're further out than most of us. Most of us like the fantasy of it, but we're not going to do it. But these characters actually do it. And so that's kind of fun to live vicariously.
But the act of writing itself, what is it? Was it fun for this book, or is it fun for you? Is writing a joy, or is writing something that you just have to do that's really hard?
You know, I think it is both ways. Like, I'm a very disciplined writer, and when I don't write for a couple of days, I actually, you know, just feel like withdrawal, like nervous. But, you know, do you sit down and are you enjoying it? No. And I'm, you know, critical of my writing, and so, you know, it never is quite the way I had imagined it or is as good. But then there are passages that you just, you know, that just feel right, and that's very rewarding. So it's a mixed bag. I mean, I think there's a satisfaction about getting your vision down on the paper, and that's wonderful, and that's why I keep on doing it. It's nice when you have somebody like in an audience say, you know, oh, that passage with, you know, I've been through that, and that's where I'm going through, and I just love that, or I love that character, I love that scene. And it's nice to be able to connect with somebody on that level.
I love it that you just talked about satisfaction, because on your website, which I mentioned I'm staring at, there's a big Rolling Stones mouth there where you have a playlist for The Last Good Paradise.
Which was great fun to do, by the way, because I love that music. That's from, you know, my high school kind of music. So I enjoyed just narrowing it down and coming up with some good songs to listen to.
And what? And are we going to listen to I Don't Get No Satisfaction from the Rolling Stones?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my goodness. So The Last Good Paradise, I believe, is your third novel, if I'm counting correctly.
Yes.
Is it as exciting to know that this third work of yours is going to be out in the world as it was for when The Lotus Eaters came out?
You know, it's exciting every single book that comes out. It always seems a miracle that by the time you have your first idea to the time you're, you know, holding the book in your hand, it's always extremely exciting. I think nothing is as overwhelming as the first book coming out, because that's kind of how you define yourself as if you're, you know, I don't believe, by the way, because I'm a teacher, and I don't believe you define yourself by what you've published. I think you define yourself by what you do every day. And if you're a writer, and if you write every day, then you're a writer. But it is a special moment when you first have a book, because then, you know, to the world outside, you have something to show them. So that's very special. But for me, every single book, you know, matters a lot, and they're all very different from each other. That's the way I work. But it's nice to start having a body of work that, even though that each one is very different from the other, it's nice to, you know, have kind of an oeuvre where you have different aspects of yourself on display. I think of it like kind of an actor. An actor can do serious movies, and they can do comedy movies, and they do television stuff, and they do, you know, major pictures, and it's kind of, you know, showing different aspects of yourself. So that's a lot of fun.
So now, do you teach still?
You know, I have been teaching off and on. I kind of do private workshops right now, and I'm looking, you know, to teach. I enjoy it. It kind of grounds me, because, you know, right now I'm working on my next book really hard, and it kind of grounds you to talk to students and kind of feel like you're working together. So I plan to do it part-time, but it's really hard to juggle, because, you know, you're kind of using the same part of your brain. So when you're reading a lot of student work, I find it's hard to focus on your own. So I'm trying to find a good mix, because I like doing both.
Now, were you a teacher, though, before you became a novelist and short story writer?
I wasn't really. I had been teaching, you know, some writing courses online and then through different workshops and stuff. But I wasn't doing that full time. I kind of had, you know, different jobs, and I worked in an arts art gallery and in an art studio and in graphics and just the different stuff, with the writing always being, you know, the main focus and the work. I always look at it as the work in the world was kind of the research, you know, the stuff, the grist for the mill of the writing.
Oh, sure. And so now, is this life that you're living now as a full-time novelist, is this where you always hoped that you would be?
I mean, it is. It's a great thing to be able to get up every morning and to focus exactly on what you want to do. And I love talking about books, and I love to, you know, go out and talk to people about, you know, the books I'm reading, the books that I'm writing, and spending all day working on a particular story like the one I'm working on right now. It's a wonderful place to be. So, yeah, it's nice.
And so, what are you reading right now?
The funny thing is that I'm doing so much research right now. I'm working on a historical novel, so I'm deep in research. But I read, you know, everything I can when I have spare time. So different books.
And is it a secret what time period, or, you know, can you give us some hint about what you're focused on with this new novel, or do you keep it quiet until?
It's a historical novel, so that's all I can give you that, and it's set in the American West period, but that's all I'll talk about right now.
Okay, that's fair enough, and we should be talking about The Last Good Paradise anyway. So is there something that you're hoping that people are going to walk away from this new novel having discovered or experienced?
In a way, I think, because I did write it very much with the idea of people that you're at a certain period in your life, and I don't think it's necessarily chronological. If you're a certain point in your career or in your marriage or wherever where you, you know, it's kind of like the second act. So the excitement of having all of that, and then you're wondering, you know, is this what I want, and is this what I'm going to be doing until I retire, and that feeling that maybe, you know, you're trapped and you can't do anything else. I like this idea because you're playing with kind of these goofy, flawed characters, and, you know, this is out there and it's funny. But I would hope that people recognize an aspect of their own life, and that they kind of, you know, by watching these characters go about it, maybe if they need that nudge to do something different, or, you know, to open a coffee shop, or to go off for a long vacation, or do something that they've always dreamed of, I'd like to think that this might give them that little nudge to maybe actually go do that, maybe even go and write that book, you know, that a lot of people always come up to me and say, oh, I've always wanted to write a book, but I never had time, and never, you know, had the courage to do it. So I'm kind of hoping that it's a little bit of that.
And Tatiana, is there something that we see or learn about you in the reading of this book?
Oh, I don't think so. I always think, I mean, the book overall always reflects the author, but I stay totally out of it as far as being autobiographical or anything. So I just I look at myself as just the guy behind the curtain getting it all going.
So you have a beautiful website, which if you could give us the web address, that would be great. Is that the best place for people to go to find out where you are and what you're doing?
Yeah. I try to keep that updated with the, you know, whatever articles I'm writing and with my newest projects and, you know, whatever's going on with the different books. So that's just under my name.
Okay, excellent. And where are you going to go on tour for this book?
I've been doing a bunch of blog things. I've been writing a bunch of things, and right now I'm in the middle of a move from Southern California to Northern California, and then I will be, you know, doing a lot of local events and a lot of reading and festivals, hopefully in the summer and fall.
Any plans, do you think, to come to New England, over to the East Coast somewhere?
I'm definitely going to wait for the good weather, but I hope so.
Wonderful. Well, we'll definitely keep an eye out for you. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Like Tatiana, so many writers find themselves inspired by and turning to Mark Twain, whose house here in Connecticut I've had the pleasure to visit many times, and where there are always fascinating literary events being scheduled. You should definitely check that out. With that suggestion bubbling around in your head, I'm going to say thank you to you and to my guests. So thank you, Rose Tremaine, Tatiana Soli, and Rachel Urquhart. Thanks also to you for listening tonight. I hope that you'll be back with us next Monday night. In the meantime, if you don't already follow us on Twitter or Tumblr, please do. We also have a Facebook page that we would love you to like. Any suggestions for authors or books to be featured on the show, please don't hesitate to reach out to us at litnewengland@gmail.com. Until next Monday, I wish you a great week and great reading. Thank you.